Welcome to The Food Professor, Episode 3. I'm Michael LeBlanc.
And I'm Sylvain Charlebois.
Well, Sylvain, let's jump right in. You know, I when we started talking about doing this podcast together, you said, the timing is great, I'll have the summer, it's relaxing, I'll write a few papers. How's that working out for you so far? So,
So our team is has never been as busy as now, to be honest. We're overwhelmed with different projects. Last time I counted, I think we were up to 15 different research projects at the lab.
Wow.
Of course, the challenge was, we have a staff of 22 now. Now, of course, the challenge is that I don't see any of them. We just see right. each other on screen, which is always difficult. A lot of people are listening to the podcast without knowing what is academic research, but it's of course, it's like anything in life. It's much easier when we can see each other, deal with subtleties,
collaborate, all that stuff.
Yeah, it's been more challenging, but it's certainly possible. With COVID, the difference between COVID and any other projects we've done is that things change every single day. And of course, as we listen to these announcements, whether it's from the federal government, from provinces, from other countries, there are daily reports about what's happening. It always triggers a new train of thought on our end and say, well, maybe we should do this or maybe we should do that. So I think we're at capacity now. We can do more. But as we progress into the summer and into the fall, we'll start releasing more of these results and allowing the public to appreciate what we've been doing on COVID.
Well, let's jump right into one of them you released this week. Timing is everything, talking about restaurants and Canadian attitudes towards going out to restaurants and what they've been doing and what they intend to do. I found it fascinating research. It's a sector that's got such challenges.
What was the most surprising result that you find, Michael, in our
study?
Well,
for me, it was the double-digit percentage of Canadians that want mannequins in the chairs beside them to make it feel like, 12%?
12%, yeah. No, it's...
To me, that was... Some of it didn't surprise me. I was heartened. I love restaurants. I asked my wife to marry me in a restaurant, and that so many Canadians had continued to support restaurants by doing takeout. And I think, if I'm not wrong, there hasn't been a reported issue of any kind of COVID transfer doing it that way. So I think, you know, it's a win-win-win. So I was thrilled to see so many Canadians, you know, still supporting restaurants, big and small. I think that came out. But boy, some of the research, when they talk about, you know, the intention now versus a year ago, I mean, it points to some trouble for the restaurant industry. What did you think about the research and the output?
I didn't know what to expect before we got the data from Angus Reid, our partner in this project. I would say that it is, to me at least, a glass half full story. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what kind of legacy COVID would leave behind after 3 months of confinement. I mean, you're listening to the news, going on social media, that's all we were hearing about, how to protect ourselves. And all of a sudden we're asked to get out and enjoy life and, you know, have a pint on a patio or have a nice meal in a restaurant. So it feels sort of counterintuitive for a lot of people. So I wasn't overly surprised that Canadians are absolutely split in the middle. Half of us want to go out this summer, while the other half are saying, not now, and let's wait for the second wave to happen, and then we'll see.
That was another interesting observation for me, that there was this surety almost that I'll just wait for the second wave. Like, it's not even... if there's a second wave, was the kind of the vibe. It was like, well, there'll be a second wave, so I'll just wait till that washes through. That's fascinating in and of itself.
Absolutely. There is almost one Canadian in five are actually planning to get out as soon as possible, 18%. So it's actually reassuring. And to your point earlier, I was really pleasantly surprised to see how many people want to support independent restaurant operators specifically, recognizing that COVID may may affect them more so than chain operators who are part of a large network. So in terms of supply chains, in terms of the support that they have access to, it's just not the same for independent restaurant operators. So I was actually quite happy to see that. Now, of course, not all of them will survive COVID, but and I'm happy to see that some provinces are thinking about opening up restaurants, including Quebec and Ontario, over the next week or two.
Yeah, regionally as well. And at the same time, some of the provinces are putting a moratorium on evictions, which, you know, when you talk about independent restaurants, I mean, their biggest cost probably is rent. So it's good to see a couple of policy issues. And then, you know, now we talk about, as you said, the cities opening up kind of regionally, not yet, as we record this, not yet in Montreal or the GTA, but, you know, a lot of emphasis I'm reading on patios, right, is, you know, as we understand some of the science, as we think we understand it, it's better to be outside than inside. But I think it feels like some people are forgetting we're a northern climate, that this is kind of just, it's like a lifeline that curbside was when retailers were closed. Look, we can open up a patio and that's going to get us through the summer. I think that's what we're hearing, right?
That's right. That's right. It's all about getting back to business, engaging with the public, getting customers, serving customers. I mean, a lot of these people are very passionate about what they do. Now, of course, you know, Michael, some have decided not to open up at all because public health measures are very strict, very strict. Yeah. And and restaurateurs don't want to be in breach. So some of them, I just decide not to open up because they don't want to redesign their stores. I don't know if you saw the news from Starbucks today, but they were announcing that they're closing down 200 stores over the next couple of years, which is way more than usual. And I'm not surprised because I think store design has a lot to do with that. And of course, the other issue are shopping malls. Shopping malls, my goodness, because of COVID, I mean, even before COVID, they were struggling. COVID will make things much worse.
Much, much worse. And the other third element, when I think of Starbucks, and of course, let's assume they're going to open and close 100 restaurants in their fleet on any given day anyway. But I think the third element is, will we all go back to work? Because so many of their locations are based in, you know, getting that cup of coffee on the way to the office. And many retailers and other business leaders I've talked to are saying, we're not going to be rushing back anytime soon to fill those office cubicles. And that's got to impact the fast food and the fast casual kind of formats, right?
Oh, absolutely. Where is your office going to be post-COVID? That's the big question. And of course, you're seeing IT emerging. You're seeing some investments in that area. There are firms stating that they are sectors which are going to hire after COVID. Food, of course, is one. And the other one is IT, just because we do expect a lot of people to stay home to work, and a lot of people can stay home and work.
Yeah. It's interesting. I think it'll be, you know, when you look culturally, it's going to be like a hands up strategy, because as many people I talk to are saying, I could be fine never going back to work. Is when you talk to younger people, they're like, I'm crawling the walls here. I didn't buy a concrete box in a big city to sit in it 24 hours a day. I want to get to work. So
exactly.
It's going to be whatever happens. I think there's going to be, you know, what we can say with confidence, if you can say anything with confidence these days, is there'll be less people in offices for this year, probably early next year as well. And we'll see in the fullness of time, you know, the decline of the office has been talked about many, many times.
Oh, yeah.
Like, why do we all do it in offices anyway? But, you know, maybe this time a little bit more of it might stick.
Well, we are human beings. I mean, we need to interact with one another physically, I think. There is a need for that, and it does improve efficiency. Maybe not after noon on a Friday afternoon, no, but anyways, it depends on the context.
It just, as you said, it's just at the beginning of the beginning of the podcast, right? It's sometimes difficult to, you know, get the nuances and have a great group interaction and produce great results when you can't all see each other and all those things, right? Both leaders like yourself who are leading the teams and the team players themselves.
Yeah.
So I'll put a link to the survey results, great survey results in cooperation with your partners at Angus Reid. I'll put that in
lots of stuff. Yeah, lots of interesting nuggets coming out of this survey. It's our first one looking at food service, and we're planning to do others down the road as well.
And it's one of the big things we wanted to do on this podcast was just kind of add a little more depth to the research, that not to the research itself, but the commentary around the research, because you're not hard to find in media, but you sometimes get your 30 seconds of fame and then that's about it, right?
Exactly. And people are just looking for that one citation, but there's more to it. And by the way, I did have a collaborator from Dell for this project. His name is Howard Ramos. He's an amazing sociologist, and he ate that data up. He loved it. Oh yeah. And because this phenomena is just gold for sociologists. So Howard did a pretty good job analyzing some of the data for us.
All right, let's get to our new segment. We got a whole new segment you and I are pretty excited about, or very excited about. We're just launched it, called Ask the Professor, kind of like your office hours are open, the door is open. So it took me a while to figure out the right tool. But for those of you listening, you can now go online. There'll be a link in the show notes and record a voicemail to us. And then we're going to listen to them and play it. So identify who you are and where you're from. And then Sylvain's going to answer the question. And so we have our very first question. The office hours are open from Nora Valentino from Parts Unknown. She didn't tell us where she's from, but here's her question.
Should heroes be heroes all the time? Like all these workers, not just during this pandemic? They're all important all the time, not just during this time. Thank you.
All right, Sylvain. So I couldn't have planted a better question, because, you know, number two thing we wanted to talk about that you've been talking about, we have talked together off mic, is this whole concept of hero pay. You know, it's interesting that that was a question that came through, again, unsolicited. They don't know what we're going to be talking about, but it's interesting that that came through as one of the top questions, because it's a complicated issue, right? The hero pay. First of all, I think you and I might agree that the branding was just doomed to fail. I mean, when you call somebody heroes, you know, how do you go back on that? But the concept of paying premium for the frontline staff, it's complicated, right? Talk about that a bit.
Yeah, it's not easy to figure out. The economics of wage increases in food retail is very difficult, very challenging. So it's certainly a good question. And a part of me was very happy. I mean, I think a lot of Canadians were very pleased to see this recognition. I mean, these hero pay programs were celebrated because we were recognizing the hard work of grocery clerks, people working in grocery stores and distribution centers, and they don't earn a whole lot. I mean, it's anywhere between $13 to $15 an hour. It's hard to feed a family with that. And a lot of the people that actually do occupy these positions are single moms, students, seniors with fixed income, people coming from underprivileged demographic groups, and so on and so forth. So all of these people really deserve more money for the work they do. And so they worked hard. And of course, grocers had a hard time keeping these people in stores given the risks related to COVID.
Yep. So, and the government programs that also, to some degree, started to compete against that. And we're hearing that back to the restaurant sector as well. It's, you might open your doors, but you know, there's some decisions to be made based on, you know, if the government program is a bit too rich. I know they're tweaking that a bit, but
they're starting to really hanker down and making sure that people don't abuse, which is good. But I mean, when you increase hourly rates by $2, that's an increase of 10 to 15% on about 30% of your operational costs as a grocer for one store. Because you would hire anywhere between 80 to 100 FTEs a year, to operate one store. That is a lot for a store, which would generate maybe a profit margin of about 1 to 1.5%. It's a high volume, low margin business. And so it's very difficult. But it got me thinking, and we heard that that co-op in Calgary decided to end its program last week, and other grocers are thinking about ending their programs over the next few weeks. So, and in the United States, we've seen a dozen grocers end their programs.
I think Kroger was the first out the door announcing the cessation of the program, right?
That's right. He even suggested at some point that they should claw back some of the money.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine?
They did change their mind, but my goodness, it was really just, yeah, they just didn't want to create a precedent. And I suspect that unions will have something to say about that. But overall, I did have a couple of observations here. One, as you mentioned, I mean, you call people heroes, but only for a while. And I'm not sure that will help management deal with workers. So that actually may affect that relationship, unfortunately, over time. But the other issue is about automation. I mean, I think we need to have a conversation about how we use automation and robotics in food retailing. For example, the other day I went to a grocery store and I was greeted by a fine gentleman giving me a cart. He cleaned himself manually. And of course, we had to wash our hands manually as well as we enter the grocery store. And of course, when you shop around, you grab what you need. Then you show up at the cashier. The cashier cleans everything up. And you see people washing everything all over the place at all times. And you gotta wonder, my goodness, is this the only way to do this? Or can we actually have sophisticated IT machines, automation, doing all that work, very repetitive, manually intensive work, which eventually could allow perhaps grocers to perhaps reduce the number of positions, but actually have people earn more as they actually work in a grocery store doing different types of jobs. And I think we're going to have that conversation. And of course, 20 years ago, we started to deal with self-checkouts, and that really bothered a lot of people because they saw that as a threat to positions in a grocery store. But because of the pandemic, because of COVID, I actually do think that it has increased cost to operate a grocery store. But perhaps there are other ways to do certain things that are quite repetitive and manually intensive. And to be honest, Michael, I don't know if you've ever worked in a grocery store, but it's manually intensive, and it's some of these jobs nobody wants to do.
Well, you raise a bunch of great points. I mean, one, you know, when you talk about automation of these kind of cleaning tasks, I mean, basically you could perform surgery in most grocery stores now. They're so clean. You know, I think it gets to an interesting marketing discussion around being seen to be clean is important. And in other words, it used to be in the background, right? You didn't really walk people out and start cleaning shelves because you didn't want to remind people about that in pre-COVID days. Now, in COVID days, you want to reinforce visually that all these things are happening. Your experience kind of relates to that. But maybe, you know, push carts under a giant ultraviolet light cleanser instead of having someone manually wiped down. But, you know, will consumers still see that as clean? I prefer to see than think that it's clean. In other words, the second issue I wanted to talk about is this whole idea, and there is some precedent, right? When we had some pretty big wage increases, a minimum wage in Ontario, right? Remember, it jumped up like 22%. Some of the restaurants particularly, and there was a bit of kerfuffle around RBI and their franchisees, but some of the restaurants said, listen, we can't absorb this. The economics don't work. So we're going to increase the price of your coffee. Okay, is everybody good with that? And that gets to a really interesting question. Maybe your friend, the sociologist, would answer it. Ultimately, we just pay more. You know, if we want them to be heroes and the economics are the way you outlined, shouldn't we, as consumers, just be willing to pay more to keep our fellow citizens with, you know, with those wages that compensate them? I mean, that to me is a really interesting question. That's always been a bit of a governor is, you know, when consumers are shopping to save the last penny, it's hard for retailers to do anything else but be very, very efficient in a low margin business.
Oh yeah, well, I don't think it's just an interesting question. I think it is the question because
right.
12 weeks ago we celebrated hero pay programs, but are consumers willing to pay? And that's really the real question. And because food prices are going up, when we talked about this during episode 2,
4%, right? Pre-COVID, you talked about food prices going up 4% anyway. Now the price of meat is skyrocketing and all
exactly.
These things.
I think you need a loan to buy beef nowadays. But let's face it, because prices are going up, because this issue of paying grocery clerks appropriately. I think the social contract we have with the food industry is going to change as a result of COVID, because I actually do believe that the industry, the grocery business, really deserves an opportunity to retain talent, because the other issue are analytics. I mean, we're in the business of analytics ourselves at the lab, but I mean, in order to do a good job and to anticipate shifts, as we saw with COVID, you need data. But in order to process, analyze, and use data properly, you need talent. And and to retain talent, you need to pay people. You need to pay people well. And so that's why I think the grocery programs or grocers will have to think really differently about the labor force and how they want to support their strategy moving forward. The other issue is e-commerce. You need to understand data in order to anticipate what people are going to be buying online as well. And that's going to become a much larger part of their business moving forward.
Already is, right? We hear anecdotally it's jumped up to, you know, double digit percentage from what was, you know, a few single digit percentages. And I think that's going to stick one way, shape or another. It's fascinating discussion. I don't think it's going to be the last time we're going to be talking about it, by the way. So
absolutely.
Let's leave it there for that one. Now, you know, you and I have talked about, I think it was the first episode, you know, these pandemic issues, the outbreaks in the meat processing plants. They're still going on, by the way. I was reading in the U.S. they're still having difficulty. You haven't heard much about them in the media in the past couple of weeks. But now, unfortunately, we're hearing about this on the farms. In Ontario, we had one farm, you know, a couple of hundred people were diagnosed with COVID. And even, you know, reading through the articles, the farmers, you know, who bring up people, migrant workers, they're like family members, I think you've said once. I mean, these people have been coming up for decades. This isn't just like an overnight thing, and spent a lot of money to try to get them safe, but it doesn't seem to be working. And that seems to be getting worse. And I wonder what your thoughts are on two things. One, is there a better way to bring workers to the farm in this environment? And two, do you think that there's going to be fresh food shortages?
Yeah, they are cases in Southern Ontario. I know that there are cases in Nova Scotia as well. Different parts of the country are affected by COVID for sure. I mean, farmers have been affected by COVID, and I was happy to see the government recognizing that. But the question around shortages is, I think, a different one, because we can import ourselves out of a mess. And our dollar is actually quite resilient. The dollar has gone up since the start of COVID, which I thought was interesting. It went down because of the
oil, right?
Saudis decided to flood the world with oil. That has changed since then. And you're seeing more countries reducing the amount of oil they're producing. So that's why I think it's helping the Canadian dollar, but also the fact that the United States right now is a mess socially, economically, and that's also helping Canada. But because of the resiliency of our dollar, I actually do think it may help Canadian consumers if we're short on something. And I think we domestically, we will be short on things. But I think that grocers will just make sure that shelves are as full as possible, giving consumers an option. So my long answer to your question is no, I don't expect any shortages at all.
Yeah. Is there a better way to deal with, I mean, this could be an issue again, whether it's in a meat processing plant or on a farm, is there a better way to bring help or labor to these farms? Or is just this is, you know, it's difficult work. Talk about difficult work. It's difficult work not a lot of people want. And is this just the way it is structurally? And it's, you know, they're shoulder to shoulder. It's not like in a meatpacking plant. You can't put in mobile pieces of plexiglass as they walk down rows of strawberries, right? I mean, it sounds somewhat intractable.
No, migrant workers are very convenient for farmers. They get trained once, and you get the same person every year for dozens of years. I mean, university students can't compete with that. Even if you actually do find Canadians who want their jobs, who want those jobs, they may not stick around for long. And farmers, we need to retrain people. And farmers use these days very sophisticated equipment. So you need to know what you're doing. And so I do see a case there. And frankly, I mean, we are helping countries that are that have less means than Canada. I mean, why not help families that are abroad by hiring some of these people? And Canadians can do other types of jobs. I never saw a problem with migrant workers, to be honest. And I actually do see value in that. And farmers, like I said, farmers actually do build a family. And getting people in rural Canada is hard. Yeah. It's very hard. It's and it's far. And that's why, and migrant workers commit to a job, commit to a farm or a few farms. With COVID, of course, things got complicated. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that some workers may work on several farms. They do travel together. They live together. So I suspect that farmers will have to think differently about how they accommodate migrant workers in the future.
Let's get back. Last couple of things we'll talk about this episode. I listened to a webinar you were on with the cattle and meat industry, and you made some interesting points. And I guess I wanted to round up the question in and around kind of plant-based 2.0. I've seen someone launching a mixed plant red meat burger. Do you see the current state of things in terms of, you already mentioned meat prices kind of skyrocketing, problems in the processing plant? Is this another opportunity for both the vegans to make their point around meat and cattle and for the market to absorb or appreciate more plant-based proteins?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's going to be easy. Before COVID started, I actually saw 2020 as a good year, because both worlds need to coexist. I mean, I do see a lot of potential for the meat production industry, as much as there is potential for plant-based products as well. The market will mature. I'm not sure the hybrid products will be successful. For me, the bottom line is always the consumer. If you actually deprive consumers from having choices, it's a problem. And for a very long time, consumers really didn't have much choice. Now they do have more choices, which is good. And once in a while, if one person wants to eat a plant-based product, that's great. The challenge that I had, though, the problem that I had with, that I have with plant-based products is, are price points. Some of these products are still very expensive, and they shouldn't.
They're not affordable, right? I mean, they're affordable, but they're not affordable to everyone. It's not a substitute for, you know, you can change your diet and you know, save money. Some of these things are priced quite highly, right?
That's right. And that will have to, that needs to change. I was actually still looking at some of these products in a grocery store recently. And for two patties, they still retail them at $7. I do understand why they do that, because to design some of these products is very expensive, because the focus is to replicate what beef does, for example. But I think once the market starts to become more, a little bit more sophisticated around plant-based dieting, I do see flavor, taste, intent change over time. I mean, I think we'll see different products. We'll see more competition coming in, which is great. Mm-hmm. And I think it will give an opportunity for consumers to explore different options, but the benchmark won't be meat products anymore. Meat products will be part of a much larger portfolio of products. That's really the key here. And ranchers are starting to get it, I think. And pork producers as well, and chicken producers. It is an option amongst others. And you're not just selling calories, you're selling value. And it's not just about stomach share. It's about saying to the public, listen, this is what we can do. Plant-based products are great, but chicken, pork, beef, very authentic product, natural products, unprocessed. Mm. And so there are really great features that can be celebrated on both sides.
You know, we're at the end of another great episode, and we talked about dedicating this episode, and I wanted to dedicate this episode, since we started talking about restaurants, to a great chef and storyteller, Anthony Bourdain, who left us 2 years ago. I was a fan of his show, and
yes,
many great episodes, and you know, you and I talked about that, and you wanted to echo that, and then also called out a famous person in literature who was also a big fan of restaurants and food.
And
who's
food?
That?
Charles Dickens. Yes.
Yeah, really, yeah. 150 years ago, right? Yeah. 150 years ago?
He passed on 150 years ago. I don't know if you've read any of his novels. I've read three of them. And you can feel really food has always played a central part, because he was all about food security, poverty, social justice. It's embedded in all of these novels. And of course, it's hard not to talk about social justice without talking about food. So Charles Dickens actually did wonders with his pen to celebrate food in general.
Well, listen, that brings us to the end of our episode number 3. If you liked what you heard, you can subscribe on Apple, iTunes, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform. Please rate and review, and be sure to recommend to a friend or colleague in the grocery, food service, or restaurant industry. I'm Michael LeBlanc, producer and host of the Voice of Retail podcast, a bunch of other stuff.
And I'm Sylvain Charlebois.
Stay safe, everyone, and have a great couple of weeks.